Hello, dear heart. Welcome to the Flourishing Practitioners podcast, where we talk all things about space holding, caring for our clients, and succeeding in our businesses. We explore the wisdom from coaches, counselors, and healers. My name's Gabrielle Walker, and I'm so honored that you're here. Let's dive in. This conversation with Dr. Travis Bolton is from September 2022. That's how time flies. Trevor was one of my tutors when I was studying counselling, and I really appreciated his style, his humanness with us, and how he really entered into our minds about how we were learning and what might help us as new counsellors entering the space. And when we had this conversation, I was still trying to figure out in my mind how my existing therapeutic life coaching practice interacted with counselling. And I feel like more settled in that now in my body and in my practice. And it's become clearer with time. At this time, I was still trying to work out, like, how does counseling differ from life coaching? How am I going to hold this within the umbrella of Tauranga counseling? What does it all mean for my life? I knew I loved counseling. I was surprised by that factor. And yet I didn't know quite how it was going to fit in just yet. When I listen back on this, I can really hear my newness to the space. Even though I've been practicing for around 10 years, counseling is different and the energetics around it are different. So I'm trying to figure it out. And this interview is so beautifully that. I hope it serves you also to head off in a little bit of a different direction. It's been really cool to have people from across the world enter the training spaces, be so honored and so touched. The recordings, we meet weekly for 13 weeks, going through the 12 heavens, and then also a closing week on the 13th week. And there's people from across Australia, Aotearoa, New Zealand. We've got some people in the States and Europe. So wherever you are, maybe the call times won't match with you, but you will receive a recording. So just reach out if that's something that does interest you. And for now, let's dive into Connect with Trevor.
Good trip. Dr. Trevor, thank you for offering to do this talk with me and to support other practitioners and space holders. And so you're a counselor and a psychotherapist, and I'm sure so many other wonderful things that we'll get to explore. Yeah, please share how you got into counseling and psychotherapy, whatever comes up for you.
Sure, will do. And thanks for having me. It's very nice to be here. And it's good feeling to be making contact with other practitioners and new colleagues that I haven't met yet. I'm a fairly recent addition to Western Australia. I've lived in the UK most of the time, but I trained back there in the UK and in the United States for a while, quite some years ago. And I got into it. I got into counseling really through working in a job in our National Health Service in the UK. I was visiting a project which was run by a lady. She's called Jean O'Keefe. And Jean was sitting with a group of other women who were all talking about disordered eating at that time. They were in like a community center in a rural part of Yorkshire in the United Kingdom. It's like a 2-hour drive from my house in the middle of nowhere. And I went out there because I was supposed to look at projects, and if there were any good, give them money was the idea. And so I turned up and there was Jean talking to these ladies, and I was sort of sat in the room. I guess she must have invited me to be there. But anyway, I was sat there and these ladies were talking about their disordered eating, and Jean was listening and occasionally saying something. And it went on for a while like that. And I just got this overarching feeling, this is brilliant. You know, what she's doing is brilliant. She's holding space. I love that phrase. Hear it 10 times a day, probably, but I love that phrase. She's holding space for these women, and they're talking about the things that were fairly common between them, and she's obviously making reflections and doing essentially what Carl Rogers taught people to do from over 70 years ago in terms of good at holding space for people, skillful listening. And so I must have just thought, more or less there and then, I'd like to be in here doing this. You know, I'd like to be doing what she's doing. So anyway, things progressed, and I guess they probably got the money, I would imagine, for the project. And then Jean sort of invited me and said, well, what you could do is you could come here on a Thursday night and you could sit in the room, do this with us. We're going to run it as a sort of training program. What happens is you take part. So you give of yourself and reveal your own problems and secrets. And we do the same process, and we do that for, I don't know, 12 weeks or something like that. And then we get you into a position where you could be a facilitator. So it all span on from there. And I recognized Carl Rogers, particularly Carl Rogers in Gene, from an undergraduate course I'd done some while before. So I'd done a lot of formal education, a degree and a master's degree and all that kind of thing, but I'd not been practicing in counseling. And so it just span on from there. I did lots of short courses then. I did transactional analysis. I did motivational interviewing, more person-centered counseling, cognitive behavioral therapy, dialectical behavior therapy, eye movement, desensitization and reprocessing. And so I did lots and lots of courses like that over the years. Mm-hmm. Then I ran essentially disordered eating, weight management related, health related projects inside the university. We called them all Small Changes in the end. Gene and I wrote a book called Small Changes. We wrote research papers. We talked about this in the UK and around the world in different places, different forums. And that was all about us running a group therapy session for people for around their health. It was weight management and disordered eating, but the amount of anxiety, depression, people struggling with their alcohol and so forth that we saw was also tremendous. So we saw hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people in small groups over a period of about 10 years back in the early 2000s. And then because I was so interested in the motivational interviewing, particularly, and client-centered counseling, I sent up my doctorate around that. While I was at the university, I set up a program which involved me seeing people one-to-one as well as in groups. My work was getting coded by an organization called the Motivational Interviewing Network of Trainers, which is essentially a group of counselors, psychotherapists, and people particularly interested in motivational interviewing. But, you know, it's a worldwide deal, but a great deal of that is centered in Europe and the United States. There are, for instance, numerous Kiwi practitioners, for example, and folks from Australia. So that really, really tied me into counseling then. And motivational interviewing is an accessible format and an accessible modality of counseling that you can start training in pretty quickly with a two-day workshop. I'm not saying you can learn to do it in a two-day workshop, but you can get started, and it's extremely welcoming. You don't need to have a six-year psychology internship to get onto it. It's something people can start doing because they're interested in holding space. That really attracted me.
What called you about the Carl Rogers aspect? If you were thinking about that, when it comes to mind, maybe an explanation for those who don't.
Well, it was great, actually, because I didn't realize that it was one of those moments in life that would affect me for decades and years and years and years. But I was sat in there was a lady, she was a counselor, a practicing counselor in London, and she must have been called into the university to deliver this module, this unit on counseling. And what she did was she basically took the three main approaches. So a sort of Freudian psychotherapeutic approach, a Carl Rogers approach, and then a more behavioral approach. And those three things, like Freud and his couch and his unconscious and all of that stuff, id and ego and superego is in one hand. Then you've got the behaviorists, starting off with guys like Skinner way back when. But when you think about cognitive behavioral therapy and the modern adaptations of that as the behaviorist. And then you have Carl Rogers, which is very much about client-centered, person-centered approach. So the phrase person-centered listening is very much like a detailed explanation of what we mean when we say holding space. So she compared the three, and that's what you were to do. So we had an exam and a paper that we had to write comparing the three. And I just got to the end of that and thought, wow, Rogers wins.
Obviously, right. Person-centered is a term that's sometimes thrown around a lot. Do you feel like it means on a deeper level if there was someone who either didn't know about it or someone who did but wanted more nuance in terms of what that means? How would you describe that?
Well, it is nuanced. And broadly speaking, the notion is literally accepting that the other person is certainly of equal value and worth in this relationship between the two of you. And that in relation to expertise, they know a lot more about themselves than you do. And they really are the expert in the room. And you're there to be helpful and facilitative and sure you bring things to the conversation. So it's very much about, it's literally about being in tune with that person and trying to find out what it is that they want and what they need and what's going on for them. So it's listening at a very deep level.
Yeah, I love that explanation. And I just wanted to put pop in there because I'm thinking of, when I'm trying to explain it to others, what I notice in myself is when I falter with it, when I tend to lose that connection of person-centeredness, is if I'm feeling insecure or there's like this energy that comes over me of like, oh, well, I know the answer. It's like that desire to think of the worst, you know? So it's like, and is it real? Do you find that it can be a bit of a dance within yourself too?
All the time. Yeah, I find that it is all the time, and that maybe time has managed to subdue that a little bit, but that answer coming bursting forth that is the right answer or the solution, I think is common to people, but also perhaps even stronger in people who are helpers. If we're drawn towards helping other people, and that's our meaning, we're going to be helpful and useful to other people, then maybe that automatic response of wanting to provide a solution is strong in us. Things, I mean, I will share with you, I was having a conversation with my lovely supervisor yesterday, my now retired supervisor. He supervises me, but he's retired from being a psychologist. And we were having this discussion where I was talking about a client who was dysregulated and particularly anxious. And I noticed that in the session and was working towards helping ground him to help him feel a little bit less anxious actually in the session. But I realized after we'd parted company that mostly that was coming from me. You know, I'd got the grounding exercises. I'd got the experience of meeting emotionally dysregulated people, sometimes with even with psychosis, people with severe problems. And because I know, oh, well, this works for calming people down and making them feel at ease. And so that was the appropriate thing to do. But after we'd left parted company, I realized that some of the things that I did were working and some of them were not. And the obvious thing that I could have done is, because at one point I said to the client, how are you feeling right now? And he said, pretty anxious. And it was clear that he was. But what I didn't do, what I didn't say was, of the things that we're doing together, what is it that's helping? And what, if anything's getting in the way? Because something in that talk, that grounding talk, although my intention was absolutely, of course, to do the right thing and be very helpful, was actually triggering it, was not helping. And my reflection on that, and talking to my supervisor, was, well, clearly I could have asked him. I could have said to him, well, what am I doing that is not so helpful? Because I'll avoid that and stick with the things that are working.
Yes, thank you so much for sharing that. I think it's a really permission giving as well to other people to be in their exploration of those things. And plops in for me, well, I think I've gained the most from the counseling training. And it's like, literally ask everything. Like, is that working?
Yeah.
Like, because prior, I think I was making a few assumptions of like, oh, well, that's for most people. So we'll just sort of round that out where it's like, it's really given me so much insight into how individual everyone is and how even one word can have so much different meaning for a different, and a word that we may be using very neutrally and well-meaningly could have a completely different meaning for that person.
Yeah, it's nicely put. I think that's it, isn't it? The intention isn't necessarily the receipt. And so a lot of the time that happens in conversations, obviously, where you intended something that was fairly neutral, but the receipt has been different. You know, someone's perceived that as an attack, for example, when your intention was quite different. So it, I guess, just tells me that I need to be, what I need to be doing in that instance is listening harder. Sort of like listening harder than I was.
How do you understand holding space? Like, how would you describe that on a more nuanced level?
Certainly putting myself to one side. That's one of the things, is like holding space is partly about, putting my stuff to one side, my concerns of the morning or the later afternoon or generally in life to one side, so that I have just given as close as I can to 100% attention to what that person's saying.
How would you describe motivation?
Well, it's, in a nutshell, MI is born out of Rogers again, out of Carl Rogers again. There's no MIs. This is what the originators, Bill Miller and Steve Rolnick, would say, is there's no motivational interviewing without Rogers. So that's lovely, because, I mean, that his work in relation to how to be or how to hold space with a client really filters into all therapies now. So even if you're focusing on a solution-focused approach or a cognitive behavioral approach, you'll find that the attending skills and the way of treating the person and being with the person is influenced by this notion of person-centered counseling. So MI is absolutely based on and predicated on the idea of person-centered casting. But it also has a very natty way of encapsulating that Rogerian approach. Now, there's a quantitative way of counting and measuring what you're doing. And I find myself doing this a lot in training with people. So for example, when you think about the holding space notion, one of the things that you'd be interested in is how much am I talking compared to the other person? So, and proportionately, given that it's a counseling conversation, you would like to feel that the client would be speaking the most. And so the notion of a talk time ratio, which you and I have probably discussed before, but the talk time ratio is me identifying how much am I speaking compared to the person that I'm holding space for. And that sort of idea, talk time ratio and measurement of my own behaviors. What am I doing when I do speak to the client? Am I asking them an open question or a closed question? Am I affirming a quality in that person in some way, something that I've noticed that's true, or just reflecting back something that's obvious that they just said, I'm tired, and I reflect back that they're tired? Or am I reflecting something else that's deeper in relation to their feeling or a meaning that's come out of what they've said? So those things being measured, those behaviors, things like, I mean, that acronym, I've just sort of more or less introduced it, OARS, is common in MI. It can get, it's like this for anybody that's really into something, but it gets a bit annoying that perhaps people see something like motivational interviewing as just OARS or just something that's used for brief interventions, neither of which are actually true. But yeah, OARS is open questions, affirmations, reflections or reflective listening and reflections and summaries. So they're behaviors that are really typically done for all of us that are holding space. And it's especially nice for people training, I suppose, because you can look at your behaviors. If you replay a recording, you can look at your behaviors and see in each instance, how long were they talking versus me? And what was I doing? Every time I made an utterance, what was it? What did I do? And that's really helpful. It's really helpful because you'd be able to see whether you're suggesting or whether you, God forbid, you interrupted births, that kind of thing, the stuff that you're trying to eradicate or reduce. And you'd see all the good stuff. You'd see all of the positive bits that made the person really understand that you were listening or really feel that you were listening.
It's the intention of that really active listening. My understanding is it's to create more longitudinal, more lasting change. Is that correct?
That's a good point, I guess, because MI was born out of the addictions field. So that was one of the big things about alcohol and addictions. And it's very much the real sort of point where it diverges and becomes its own thing rather than just client-centered counseling is the notion of helping people resolve their ambivalence. So people obviously feel ambivalent about things, including drinking, that they get something from it or they would do it, but also it could be awful and destructive as well. So they've got that continuous ambivalence. And when you think about it, ambivalence is the same with take your pick, really. I'd like to get in really great shape, but I also like eating cheesecake and sitting on the sofa. So you're kind of like, we're ambivalent about things. And MI focuses on that ambivalence and its resolution. And it does that by being more directive than client-centered counseling suggested. So Rogers originally was talking really about entering into the world of the person and following them and not trying to direct and lead them, but following them. So that was the original idea. Now MI, it is directive as well as client person-centered. So for example, in those open questions, if I'm saying to a client, well, if you did decide to make that change, what would you get from it? Because when you ask a question like that, of course, people will say, well, my clothes would fit better. I'd be able to go out shopping again. I'd be able to get down onto the rug and play with the grandkids without having pain in my knees. They start talking about the reasons for change. They start talking about, once you've opened that up and invited them, they start saying why they should, could, have to, need, ought to make a change, the reasons for change. So that then becomes change talk, and eliciting change talk in a client, it turns out to be very powerful. So if you're asking me that question and I say, well, I ought to do something about it, really. And then you say, well, what do you mean when you say you ought to? And I say, well, you know, it would be better for my health if I was to cut down on my drinking. Maybe my kids wouldn't be so mad at me, or I wouldn't get into so much trouble, or I'd be able to hold down a job, or whatever the things are that come up there. Of course, I'm talking about reasons for change. And as the practitioner, we're sitting back and saying, oh, I see. Right. So you'd get a job. You'd have a better relationship with your family. You feel like your health would be better. You'd be less cloudy in the morning. I get it. I see. And we're just reflecting back with the person's internal dilemma, because they'll say, but, you know, it changes my headspace. And, you know, it's a pretty difficult place to be inside my head. So it's quite nice to change that headspace and switch it all off a little bit. And you go, right, okay. So there are reasons that drive you to keep on doing it. And then some other pretty powerful reasons for change. Well, I am being directive, because I might, in that conversation, I might choose to do things like reflect the negativity, if you want. I suppose it's the negativity, the keeping the status quo of staying drinking. But then I'm very likely to end that reflection with, and then there's the reasons of holding down a job, your relationship with your family, feeling like your health is going to improve at the end. Because it tends to be that people pick up on that and they focus on the last thing you said. Change talk is important, and that in motivational interviewing. And change talk, especially if you look at the work of Paul Amrine in the United States, he was following conversations. And again, I don't want to do Paul any injustice and get this clear here, but he essentially listened to conversations that were helping focused, and when people said, I should, I could, I ought to, that sort of thing, even I need to, that was one strength of change talk. That predicted, it was related to people changing, but it's weaker than people saying, I am going to, I will, you know, I'm tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock. So he differentiated between preparatory change talk, I should, I could, I ought to, mobilizing, I am going to, and I will. And it turned out that the more people elicited the change talk in clients, the stronger it became, the more likely it was to evolve into sort of more mobilizing language. If somebody's come to see you and they say, well, look, Gabrielle, I've come to see you because I'm struggling with my alcohol intake and that's what I want help with. I guess you've just opened the door to say, I'm expecting you to do things that might help me reduce or control it. And then MI comes in and is perhaps you could say a little bit manipulative, because I choose to do things, well, elicit the change talk, but purposefully focus on the direction of change. There are problems for doing this and there's reasons for you to keep on drinking. And I see that they're pretty strong and that's important. You've had a real hard time of it, blah, blah, blah. And then there's the fact that you feel like you might save your life and your relationships and this and that if you could manage to change it.
In the context of more the brief intervention space, is there suggestions you would give to those practitioners if their workplace is instructing them in a non-judgmental manner?
Yeah.
To engage with that? Because in the counselling space, like, we have that luxury of a bit more time often. In a way, yeah. There's that rapport building can happen over a bit more time than, say, with other intervention spaces.
One of the core underpinnings of the MI approach, of course, is the whole client-centered thing. So in terms of like a way of being and an entire and complete psychotherapy, it's good. And so the aspect of things like the change talk and helping sort of help draw out the motivation that's inside someone, I mean, that's important, because it's not about instilling motivation from the outside, it's drawing out the motivation that's already inside somebody. That is an extremely important element, but there's just simply nothing to really disagree with in relation to the approach for a way of being with a client, even if it's long-term, because of course the central points are client-centered, reflective, congruent, listening relationship between the client and the practitioner. And even if you look at the technical aspects and the things that people are doing technically, if I was to come up with an example with my MI approach, I might do something like say, well, I was just wondering here now whether there was something that some of my other clients have found useful that I could introduce to you. So that I'm checking very carefully to see if they're interested in my advice or my whatever it is I'm going to suggest. And then the client might well say yes to that. And I say, well, They've taken this approach called acceptance commitment therapy for their anxiety. And it's a kind of evidence-based approach. There's six phases to it. There's exercises and things that are really useful within it. And I could describe that to you and go through with you in brief to see whether we think it might be useful for you. And after I've done that, I might then say, well, what do you think to that idea? To check in what they think. That's kind of that process, elicit. So I elicit whether you'd like me to give you the thing that I've got in mind. And then I provide it if you do want me to. And then I check in with you to see what you're thinking. How have you received? What do you think to that idea? Does that sound like it's a goer? Because you got the chance to say, no, not really. I've heard of that. It doesn't really appeal, or I don't think it works. Or whatever you're going to say, yes, let's give it a go. It'll be great. It's a particular process used a lot, again, in motivational interviewing, elicit, provide, elicit. So it's technical, but you'll notice that the thing that I'm providing is a suggestion that we might work on acceptance commitment therapy together. I find that it's a terrific surrounding approach for integrating other forms of therapy. It's very, very adaptable and inclusive to anything else you might be doing.
If I'm thinking of my trainees, for them, I would really love any suggestions on how they really listen to what the client is asking. Because for us, it's a bit different than that particular context where there's an obvious issue, even though they're often that. So the client's coming and they may not know exactly what they're working with, but listen to what it is they're doing that day. I would just love to tease that out a little bit.
I think the thing is with that idea of, and we're going back to Rogers again, but that idea of being congruent. And here you are, the two of you entering into this curious relationship where the person might be, they might be, as you said, confused about what it is exactly. And that happens a lot in my consult the room that we're sat in now, but that people would come through and say, well, I don't really know, you know, it's a bit of a mess at the moment. It's a bit of a tangle and I'm not sure what to do or what I'm supposed to do or what I need, but let me tell you all about it. And off you go. And I suppose from a practitioner point of view, it's really important to A, say, well, okay, let me sit and listen and hear what that story is and all the stuff that's tangled up that's such a mess. And if you're going through that and you get to the point where you think, well, I feel confused, that's a good thing because the client's confused. And so you've probably been fairly empathetic if you feel confused yourself. You're probably really getting into their frame of reference because they're confused. And I mean, the congruency part is really where we might be saying, well, there was this and there's this and there's that and there's this and there's that. And it's all, you know, it's really quite overwhelming. I can tell that at the moment for you. But it really feels like, you know, a confusing place over where to start. And I kind of feel the same. You know, I feel as well like I'm not really sure where to start with it because I'm being very congruent with what's coming up inside me. So if it's helpful, that's a good thing, isn't it? Where you sort of say, well, you've had an awful lot of stuff happening and it doesn't seem any wonder to me that it's confusing. And I kind of feel a bit confused myself in terms of where we might start with that. But of course, from the client's point of view, that I stand a really good chance of achieving good listening. I stand a good chance of getting that far anyway, before we move on to whatever we're going to do next to try and untangle this mess.
So for our trainees, we aren't talking for as long, but there's still an aspect of doing body work or things like that where you can sometimes pop into the savior or the helper or that.
Cool.
You know, we're literally standing over a body. Yeah. But there's that power dynamic there. But there's that. For me, just one of those important pieces for terms of what I share is that really just listening to what that person needs. Really active skills, because I think it's a skill. Like it is this practice, and there's little nuances to it where we may not realize in everyday lives that we are or are not doing that. And everyone describes it in their understanding. And their...
As you were talking there, I thought the thing is we probably... One of the difficulties with this holding space idea is probably getting caught up in ourselves. And so that idea of putting yourself to one side can become quite difficult. And maybe we also could get caught up. It was something that Steve Rolnick, one of the originators of MI, said one day to me in a workshop, was like, he catches himself being clever. He then says, oh, stop doing that. That's not. I mean, he, in objective terms, he is clever. He's a super professor with all these kind of plaudits and whatnot, you know, but what he's saying is, I don't need to be clever. That's not the point. I'm trying to be helpful. So I really want to put that to one side. And I suppose cleverness is a sort of the sort of thing that you would do maybe in Freudian type psychology, where you're interpreting and say, I've got you. I can work out what the meaning of that is. Now I think, well, okay, that's difficult if you're involved for a long time not to make associations inside your own head, but that isn't necessarily always useful. It's like, well, what is most useful to this person right now is the question that should constantly be going through us, I suppose.
I think that's the key point. It's like every person, even if you've seen them over a period, right now they're a different person. And right now they may have come to you with a different thing or a different perspective that they're willing to unravel to you or show to you.
Yes. What a nice reflection that is for the client to hear too. Is like, if we get a good relationship, I tend to ask my clients how they think we're getting on together. So I tend to do that in the first session when we've had some time together. So, well, what do you make of this relationship? You know, the two of us, we've been talking for 50 minutes or whatever, and I'm sort of interested in what you think. What are you thinking about that? Because that's important. And then being different at different times. Right now, you might be a lady who's quite emotionally dysregulated and upset because we're talking about emotive things and that's what you've come here for. But you might be a powerful career woman tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. And I know that that's true. It doesn't mean that you're that way now, because we're different things at different times, and it's okay. You know, it's good. Clients seem to like the idea of that because it absolutely respects the fact that when you're in a vulnerable and emotional and sharing, offloading type space, of course, you're not the dynamic, organized sort of person you might be, you know, at 2 p.m. the next day. But it's nice for us to recognize that, isn't it, in people? We make tacit acknowledgement of that. Well, all people are not all the same at all times.
I think it's essential. We're also dealing with the part that comes to therapy. There's all these other parts of this person. If we're deciding that it's who that person is, this part that we see.
Yes.
We are seeing their potential, actually.
Yes. Yeah, right.
That's my view. But at the same time, being able to genuinely be in resonance with, or congruence, to use your language, with that piece that showed up is so beautiful. And I've learned so much, actually. I think I'm a better client from my clients because their ability to show up, like really show up for their sessions, made me go, oh, gosh, sometimes I don't really show up to mine. I might have been holding a bit, because over time I've gone, if I want to get the most out of this, I should show up like with the bits that actually need healing.
Yeah. That's a good point. And with your trainees, you're sort of expecting your clients, of course, they need at times anyway to expose those vulnerable parts. And so we need to be doing the same in training and with each other. I think is essential, because it's sort of, you know, like going back to that point about I could be a disheveled emotional mess at 8 a.m., but I might have, some very different parts to me in the rest of my life. And maybe it's okay. It's hard because humans, that's probably competency that's a threat there. You know, if I'm a disheveled mess and I get emotional upset that I look incompetent or weak in some way, well, that's not good. You know, that's not very manly, so I mustn't do that. Well, okay, you probably don't want to be breaking into tears in the middle of work continuously. It probably would cause problems at some level. But this is therapy. You've locked the door. It's confidential. There's only the two of us. I'm not going to ever reveal the details to anybody else, except for some very exceptional circumstances. And that's the whole point. The rapport and the trust and the safety is the having space to be able to get all of that stuff out and not worry about it. Then you can go and shout at your employees later that day. You're not all things to all people. The same with the clients. The degree to which, how much of yourself do you put into or give to a client? I'm not saying I've got the answer. I'm saying it's an important question to ask, because obviously you don't want to be offloading your particular problems, because that's not what it's about. It's about them. But I also gain a very strong sense of people very much liking the fact that you present as a human being. You might not have all of your relationships as perfect and everything in your life in this kind of almost ordered, beautiful, balanced way. We're like a driving instructor saying, well, I've got to be good at driving to do the job, or it's not going to look right. Yeah. So maybe we buy into that a little bit and think, well, we need to be absolutely psychologically, spiritually balanced.
Okay. Well, I win over the most personal breakdowns. It's when there's something that could be like, say, talking or counseling or working with someone with something that I'm struggling with. And I'll be like, I'm feeling incongruent. Even if they're coming up with it, it feels like me holding space is somehow not right. There seems to be that can sometimes cause some tension inside of me.
Like you said, almost an incongruency or something. Yeah, because your own things are coming up while they're that's a really good talking point, though. I mean, because I think, and you know, the last 2 years I've had that experience. So unfortunately for me, in the last 2 years, I lost my brother and my mother. So a year ago, I lost my brother, and 2 years ago, almost to the day, I lost my mother. And so obviously that's been a hard time personally. But in that time, interestingly, I've had clients who lost their mothers or lost their brothers. And there's just that moment, of course, where that conversation comes up. I've come to see you because I'm grieving and this is what's happened. And of course, immediately your radar picks that up and says, oh, right, okay, this could be triggering. And I suppose it's quite useful in the sense that you have the opportunity then to say, well, okay, that's that. What are we going to do with that? This is not my stuff. It's somebody else that I'm listening to. It might be that you might divulge something of that. I mean, to say, well, you know, you've had your own experience, because again, it's about the fact that you're a human and you have losses as well. And that's okay, I guess, as long as I don't go and dive into my grief or assume that there's the similarity extends to the point where, you know, we're sharing exactly the same experience, because we stand a real chance of missing things if their feelings and experience are quite different to our own.
I think that's the key point. It's like, sharing it as a connection point rather than the normal relationship. Oh, here, blah, blah, blah. It's like, I don't know the word for that. But, you know, so how sometimes the conversation, you're just like thinking about the next thing to share. Yes. So it's not that, but it's a connection point. Like, oh, yeah, like, I totally understand that. That's how
it's a connection point. I don't think there's a better phrase for it, whatever you call it. I think the only thing you're trying to achieve there is to say, well, you know, things happen to me too, and it's not to either diminish or expand whatever they're feeling, but just that point where you go, oh, right, yeah, there's some camaraderie and notion of a connection there, and you could leave it at that in a sense, and you sort of go back onto, well, what is it, what's going on for you?
And then the thing I was also curious about was around the point where you said that for you, when you step into, say, a counseling space or holding space, that you step back. I did that a lot, especially initially. And then it got to be where I always felt like two mates, and I needed to integrate them a little bit more. So bring a bit more of me into my sessions.
Yes.
Because always stepping back starting to feel inauthentic. Yeah. So I don't know exactly what my question is, but do you have any thoughts on that? What does stepping back mean?
Yeah. I think the aficionados in this space, the kind of scientific studiers of counseling and therapy, are saying it's okay to be congruent and express things that are coming up for you if in some way it's useful to the client. And I think that's probably right. It internally, we're probably gauging that and thinking, well, is that in any way helpful to them? And that's probably quite an important question to ask. It's sort of having that, you really, congruency is really not necessarily sharing everything that comes up new, but it is about being aware of everything. If I sit and I think, oh my goodness, I'm triggered because this guy is close enough to my age and has lost his brother, and there's enough similarity to draw that comparison. And so maybe internally I'm saying, well, okay, yeah, but it's not your brother, and you'll have to put that to one side and make sure you tune into his experience and make sure you're not concentrating on your own. So that might be the internal conversation. And none of it comes out particularly. It's just I'm being congruent, saying, all right, so I know that that might trigger me a little bit, and so I'll watch out for that. And that's my congruency. And if it seems appropriate in some way as a contact point, as you said, a contact point, it's like, well, oh yeah, I can share with you a loss too that sort of relates in some way to your own. And leave it at that, because there's just that kind of, you say, it's just the person going, oh, all right. So it's just a contact point. I don't want to talk about that and explore my grief, but I do want to say I'm a human. These things happen to all of us. Hey, you know. Yeah.
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 That's already fair about your
background. Well, thank you for saying that. Yeah. Yeah. It's been an interesting time, I guess, because I'm exploring other people's grief with them. In some ways, again, I'm going back to a supervisory conversation yesterday. It's been perhaps helpful and cathartic because I've got my own experience, and then I know that what that means for me, but I don't know what that means for my clients. They're different. Their grief is different, in some ways similar, but always unique and different. But it's helpful, I think, in terms of me having to live with and get on with my own grief, hearing from them. You know, you've come alongside each other in the sense that your experience is different. And if I really try hard, maybe I can understand your experience. And it's different to mine. But there's a solidarity in the fact that the human condition affects us all.
I really relate to that as well. Walking alongside or someone else's healing and insights, I'm like, whoa, that's actually quite powerful for my own little journey. I'll just put that in the heart space.
Good.
And then in terms of your transition, we were talking a little bit before we started chatting about that transition from, say, working. You've had this really long career, really, working for more, I guess, other organizations, corporate or academia, now being in private practice.
Yeah.
And was there anything that comes up for you to share in that?
Yeah, lots comes up. It's been an interesting time, difficult time. I was academically involved before I came to Western Australia about 3 years ago, 3.5 years ago. So got lots of things that I needed to do for my employer, for the university, but also quite a lot of license to direct my own research, to direct my own teaching. So what happened and what we did was directed by me, and that was quite nice. And yet at the same time, there's a lot of restriction in terms of the administrative requirements of the organization. And it was quite nice to let that go on one level. But then I found myself here a little bit adrift. I was doing bits of work here and there, teaching at different universities in Western Australia. But I wasn't really full-time employed or engaged in a role. And that was a very interesting time to sort of feel a bit like I'd lost my identity and that I was, well, I don't want to use the phrase free-falling, but I was a bit concerned for a while. I was thinking, how am I going to make this work?
Just visualizing.
Falling through space. But I was worried about that and feel like I've now got through that. The COVID situation that we've all had our own individual experiences of was pretty catastrophic. That was quite difficult to get through in terms of I just decided to go it alone. Well, I got clients pretty quickly because obviously there was a lot of people seeking out psychotherapeutic help. I felt like that was great. I was really pleased to get it started, but it's taken this last couple of years to really get that off the ground and feel like I'm on an even footing in terms of the counseling side of things. I feel like I've got quite a lot of autonomy. I can make decisions that I couldn't make in the same way working for somebody else. So that's very appealing. I don't know now how I'd respond to going back to working in an administration because I quite like that autonomy aspect to it. Although I recognize it all with that comes a lot of responsibility. I'm the cleaner, I'm the marketing department, I'm the therapist, I do the accounts. It's sort of like, it's quite a lot that you have to take on board. I don't think the house has ever been so clean. I can't face my embarrassment.
When we say that, I'm like, I'm so grateful clients come because it makes me clean the house.
Yeah, well, I think that keeps, you know, some other people in the house happy as well.
When you sit on an even keel, I guess I'm just starting moving more from where I have been towards the counselling aspect. Is there anything you would suggest for me to be aware of?
It's useful, it's helpful in terms of getting started. Listening to the podcast from a counsellor who was saying that his big mistakes in the beginning were not investing in the business, that he just thought, well, the clients will magically come to me. No, they'll just do, which I'm laughing about, but as soon as he said it, I was sort of nodding, thinking, well, yeah, that's probably exactly what I thought. And also that it would just sort of happen. So I'm going to get to the point of sharing something useful here in a minute, but I don't like marketing. I don't like selling myself. There are aspects of this that need to be done that I don't particularly like. But they do work. You know, it is quite important. If I think about it carefully and then I take out an ad and I put the money into that, it's quite a low level thing, but I'll pay for that kind of, you know, interaction with Psychology Today or whatever. It does yield some results, or it has yielded some results. The thing is, you have to keep on that. I have to take my business cards, which are sat in this rather attractive...
I love it.
Yeah. And I get these things now produced with my very nice photo mix. I guess that's marketing at a very basic level. But investing in that's quite important, that there's some way of presenting yourself like you are doing with a podcast, that people will, of course, get everything from Google. So they will immediately type in counseling location. And so you need to come up, you need to appear when they put in Gabrielle and, you know, therapy. And see you there. And I don't know that I've got about 100% right yet, but the website certainly got it to a place where it appears so people can find it, and then the Psychology Today thing helped. But I mean, being frank, the biggest help for me has definitely been word of mouth. I've got some local doctors, local GPs who refer patients to me. I'm not a clinical psychologist. I'm a counselor, by the way, just to be clear about that. I have got some patients sent to me from doctors. Well, that's enormously helped. I've benefited from the fact that it's been a struggle to get people into mental health care plans expediently. They can't get in. It's 12 weeks or it's 3 months or it's 6 months or whatever. And so that was a barrier. And so I've found a little niche there where I've got space for people and quite a lot of experience, so they could send a broad range of people to me.
This discussion has been one that's been coming in me entering this space. It's like some people don't know the difference between psychologists and counsellors.
Right.
How would you describe that difference in Australia? Because I think it's also quite particular, the difference is particular to Australia as well.
It's Australia, yeah. So a clinical psychologist needs to be a registered clinical psychologist. And so they've got to have gone through the hoops that give them the registration as a clinical psychologist. And that's not the case for counselling. In reality, you could have a lot of experience and qualifications as a counsellor, or not so many. It's not, I guess the general feeling would be, yeah, it's not regulated in the same way. A counselling has got lots of training and potential and possibilities and ways of regulating, and I've got organisations such as the Australian Counselling Association and some strong will in the Northern Territories, I think, and Victoria to put counsellors in a position where they can, for instance, get the Medicare rebate, which is a huge step, of course, as far as bolstering mental health provision is concerned. That would be great as long as the regulation is in place, so you're trying to quality assure your counsellors. I think that would be really good news for people's mental health and provision, as well as for the counsellors. But there's a difference. Certainly there's a difference. You might draw it up as saying, oh, there's a difference in the length and depth of training, but it depends on the counsellor. They may have done 25 years of training.
There's a difference in the actual delivery, because I'm still grappling with this theory. Because it's pretty much the same structure depending on where the person's come, who their person is and what their approach is.
Well, one of the issues that is key and important would be diagnosis. And so with clinical psychology, you get into the business of diagnosing, of running assessment tools designed to identify whether, for instance, you have or have not got borderline personality disorder, and interpreting that and making a diagnosis. And counselors don't. But if you're, let's say, for example, the client's come through for talking therapy and the person is employing cognitive behavioral therapy, then the issue would be, I guess, the training and supervision in that person, not whether what their particular profession is, but whether they're good at delivering the cognitive behavioral therapy is what you're interested in. So I think the counseling space is growing in terms of regulation and how that's done. I think, unfortunately, it might do a disservice to the well-trained, competent counselors out there, in that it makes it look like some sort of weaker second-class alternative. But that really isn't fair.
In New Zealand, for example, counselling is actually more popular than psychology.
Right.
I don't know. It's just a really odd discussion to me, the whole thing. I'm just trying to grapple with it, because I think from my perspective, I'm going to do a little bit of client education on this stuff, because
yes,
many clients ask me about definitions
and that's the difference, yeah,
there, and you know they don't know the difference between the
side, and they don't necessarily either have to give me a reason, but I quite like it when they do. A lady who came and said, well, I talked to my doctor, she recommended you, and I thought maybe I'd be okay with male therapist, but now I don't think I will. And that's her explanation. I thought, you know what, well, good on you. You know, thank you for not sitting there suffering when you're not happy, because that's no good. And absolutely, you know, 100% wish you every success.
Yeah,
I don't want people to sit there feeling uncomfortable. I want them to sort of feel the opposite. The least that they feel is, this is okay, I'm going to be all right with this person. I at least want that as a starting point.
Is there anything else that you would feel cool to share with those who may be listening, or that popped in for you, that anecdote?
I think one of the things that occurs to me is that this is kind of getting in on the side of regulation and accreditation and all of that stuff, is that I can't really speak highly enough of how useful good quality supervision is. However you're going to obtain that, you know, whether that's really official because you're heading down the route of getting a ticket, well, okay, you must follow the rules and do whatever it is they say, get the right person that allows you to get the ticket. But even if you're not doing that, when it comes to going back to my early experience with Gene O'Keefe, and that was supervision. And I would sit by the side of Gene while we were running these groups. And in the early years, she would need to occasionally just reach her hand across and touch me on the forearm, which meant shut up. And that was excellent supervision, because I learned not to talk as served me tremendously well. No, I don't have a problem talking, but of course, in the context of therapy, I really, really want to be good at listening. So that helped. That's just an example. But wherever I've found it, wherever I've been, whether it was Miller and Rolnick and colleagues in the MI, or Gene in the counseling, or, you know, various other people, my psychologist supervisor now, that's been really, really important. I don't think I'll stop ever. I don't have any intention of stopping supervision, because it's just so powerful and useful. I mean, we're not doing supervision right now, but even our conversation this morning, it's bringing up ideas and issues and things that I'll think about possibly with the next client when they arise. And so, you know, that space with somebody else who is a peer, or maybe they're more experienced than you, or maybe even less experienced, is so incredibly useful. You talked a little bit about the idea of congruency and incongruency. And in psychology nowadays, and I'm not talking about profession of a psychologist, but just the broad study area of psychology, of course, there's a lot of focus on the idea of a divided mind, you know, that we've got a sort of reptilian amygdala type ancient brain, and we've got a more recent new sort of neocortex, prefrontal cortex bit to the brain, and that they operate differently, and that if you attach someone to a PET scan, you can see these two areas of the brain light up under different circumstances. Well, when people are operating self-talk and that kind of idea of working out what's going on inside their head, that's what's happening. Often their shame, anger, fear, concern responses related to the reptilian part of the brain. The 2 + 2 = 4 logical operations are related more to the prefrontal cortex. So that's so incredibly useful in therapy, repeatedly always stealing things from other people. One explanation I was listening to just the other day was the idea of, it kind of relates to acceptance commitment therapy actually, but the idea that I deal with my internal thoughts by saying to myself two questions, one of which is this useful? Is it helpful? Is it useful? Whatever. And then the second one is, what's it doing to me? And really, well, you could probably apply those two questions, you know, in therapy, but also for ourselves continuously. This is just nonsense. It's nonsense. It's hurtful. It's unhelpful. And it's just bringing me down. And I'm not trying to do anything with that other than notice it. That is a way of quieting the riotous voices and thoughts that we have. Is this thinking useful? And, you know, what's it doing to me? I quite like the aspect of authenticness and being a bit vulnerable and stuff and having problems as well, because the thing that people carry around inside them all the time, but they're not free to necessarily let it out. And there's good reason for that, is because they're supposed to look competent. And then if they don't, it doesn't make them a very good mate. You know, they're not a very good prospect as a partner or a mate because they might look incompetent. So we're guarded very much for good reason about that. Rolnick saying he needs to stop himself being clever and that kind of thing is amazing. It's the sort of stuff that's going on, isn't it, inside us all the time.
I'm just reflecting on my weight and exactly that competence. I just felt so incompetent.
Yeah,
bizarre way, but because I haven't had as many like slow days as I would normally have,
or right, right.
Days where I get to sort of clean up all my messes that I've created, then that incompetence feeling creeps in. So I was like, I quite like that reminder.
I think that those guys, Dachi and Ryan's self-determination theory, the biggest theory in decades that's been going on in psychology, they've got that idea that relatedness to other people, obviously, in some way, competency and autonomy, those are the three factors that we've got that really create meaning. You know, we're in trouble, we're not happy, we're in trouble or unstable in some way if we don't have those relatedness, competency. And I keep thinking about this and trying to test it out as a theory as I'm driving or whatever to the school. And I'm looking at the lollipop guy that crosses the kids across the road at the school and thinking, well, how could that be for him? And I thought, oh, no, it does. He's got competency. There's rules around when you stand up and the blowing of the whistle and where you're standing. So he's got autonomy because he decides when it's appropriate to let them go and when it's time to stop the traffic. And he's got relatedness because there he is chatting around to the kids and to waves at the parents as they stop their cars as to let them across. And I thought, it crosses all domains. CEO of a big company, he's got those needs. And the guy sat on a stool at the side of the road doing the road crossing, he's got those needs as well. They just look kind of different externally. But when I think about it, it's like people, even the shy retiring types, they want relatedness, even if it's with a small number of people. They need that to some degree. And competency and whatever it is, it could be running a multinational or it could be making cathedrals out of matchsticks. It's competency, isn't it? And some choice that we're making. How many people do you meet who are happy in their employment when they've like stand there for 12 hours on this bell conveyor belt?
I did that for 2 weeks and I was like, okay, at least when I studied Marx's theory, I understood it.
The owners of the means of production.
I was like, I literally had a visual of what they feel like.
Yeah.
With all that noise.
So, I mean, that area of neuropsychology now, isn't it? There's such an incredible and better understanding of the brain than there ever was. But that's a great idea for us practitioners for holding space is, you know, whatever's going on to the person, that technique of saying you've got at least two bits inside you that are set where you can always have that observing self that sits back and says, at the moment, what you're doing is you're ruminating about the past or you're worrying and fantasizing about the future. That's what you're doing. And then you ask yourself, well, if I can do that, it means I am separate to my thoughts. There is a bit of me that can just see what's going on, can step back and say, oh, it's just unhooks us a little bit from that unhelpful, chaotic mess that sometimes the insides of our heads. We should lead with that everything, my dear Gabrielle, because that's my thought going forward for this week, is I'm going to practice at times unhooking from unhelpful thinking and saying, well, okay, that's what you're doing at the moment. Is that output? What's it doing to you? You know?
I think that's such a beautiful and honourable place for us to conclude. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom. There's so many bits in there that sparked inspiration for me, and I'm sure
it's been very much a pleasure. I've enjoyed it very much. Thank you for having me.